Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Paul Ken, one of your hosts, and with me, as always, is my co-host and Bat cousin, Sean M. Myers. What's new, Sean?
I was just chatting with Bat Aunt Michelle, and she confided in me that she lent her friend an ascot for some kind of awards ceremony.
That's cool. I have to track down Bat Uncle George right after we're done recording, Sean. He was supposed to help me clean up, but he didn't. He is in 11 Oceans of Trouble. This month, we are thrilled to welcome the co-host of the Bat Pod to the reunion, J. David Weider. Dave, thanks for being on the show. I hope you brought something delicious.
I made my homemade, from scratch, cinnamon raisin bread.
Ooh. You had me at cinnamon.
Nice. That'll go pretty quick, I'm sure. So thanks for bringing that. So Dave, we had your podcast partner, Bill Beer, on the show way back in episode 18, so nearly a year ago. So we know you like Batman because you're the co-host of the Bat Pod, but what's your history with Batman family? Any favorite Bat family members? Give us your secret origin.
Got into Batman through the Filmation cartoon, the original, cool. Not the one with Batmite. And there was a book, a specific book. It was Fisher-Price, Christmas 1984, book and tape called Case of the Laughing Sphinx.
Okay.
And it hooked me. And it wasn't until Bill and I were talking, because that actually involves the origin of Robin, it didn't dawn on me that I'm actually into Batman by way of Dick Grayson.
Ah.
Not just as Robin, but ultimately as Nightwing.
I wholeheartedly approve.
So I try to slip some Nightwing stories in on the Bat Pod, and you're probably going to hear quite a bit of Dick Grayson in this upcoming year, just to tease that.
Excellent. I especially enjoyed your recent set of episodes on the many deaths of the Batman. We talked about that briefly in our timeline segment a while ago when it was concurrent with some issue of Batman family. Those are great stories. I'm glad you guys had a lot of fun with that.
Oh yeah. We have a run the gamut on those stories. That's what's fun about each time we come to the table. It's like, what are we reading now?
Yeah, that's cool. Excellent. So Sean, why don't you remind our listeners what our show is all about?
Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even the Tales of Gotham City and Elongated Man. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out and are excited to share their love of this era of the Batman family reunion. Let's get into Detective Comics 488, starring the Batman family.
All right. So this is Detective 488, as Sean mentioned. It has a cover date of February, March 1980, and was released on November 8th, 1979, according to Mike's Amazing World. And Sean, a big note, this is the last issue that was actually released in the 1970s. Still 64 pages, but it does have ads, five stories, and our cover artist was Dick Giordano. Guys, what do you think of this cover? Dave, you want to describe the cover and give us your thoughts?
Yeah, you have Batman being dragged towards an electric chair by three thugs while the spook is pointing them on. And for some reason, we have the ghostly heads of Robin and Batgirl. I think that's the only part that lost me so far. You know, the basic part of it was fine. And then why are Robin and Batgirl there? Did they already die?
It is funny. They try to get those ones with the characters interacting. One of our favorites was back when Batman and Ragman were in that cover, and it was Batgirl and Robin were on the back cover, even though they weren't in the story. But yeah, this was just a little weird. But Sean, how about you? What'd you think?
I think it's okay. I understand the thought of it, that they want to picture Batgirl and Robin. This is my case with these boxed covers. If this entire image was the entire cover, then maybe down in the corner or something, you could just have almost like floating heads of Batgirl and Robin instead of this ghost image. There's nothing actively wrong or horrible with the cover. Batman being dragged to an electric chair, that should be a much more exciting image. I'm not sure if it's just because the spook is just a guy in a robe. I don't know.
Yeah, the spook isn't the most visually interesting villain, that's for sure. I think that the composition, to me, like, Batman should be bigger, and the chair is too big of a presence on the cover to me. What I don't like is you've got the white border and you've got a lot of white space to the left of the Detective Comics logo.
Yeah.
And here's where you could have put Robin and Batgirl's heads there with a little blurb about their story under that. Or even the fetching image of Batgirl and Robin from way back, you know, by Mike Grell. It is a little weak compared to the last few issues. So.
Yeah. And as much as we have talked this up, we'll post this image of the cover as well as some additional pages from each of the stories in our family portrait gallery on the network's website. Paul, remind our listeners where that is.
That is at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So let's get into that first story, Sean.
Our first story is The Spook's Death Sentence for Batman, starring Batman. It's 17 pages, written by Carrie Burkett, penciled by Don Newton, inked by Dan Adkins, and it was reprinted in Tales of the Batman Don Newton hardcover from 2012. Our story begins with a narration from Simon Thatcher, who's telling the tale of how Batman foiled his escape from prison by stopping his getaway plan at the airport. We find out that his words are actually being read by Selina Kyle, formerly the Catwoman, from the book Memoirs from Death Row, written by Simon Thatcher. The story then moves to a meeting between Jeff Laird, Thatcher's co-writer, Desmond Foster, Thatcher's literary agent, Mr. Tor, publisher of Coronet Books, which released Memoirs from Death Row, and Mr. Wilton, a major stockholder of Coronet Books. During the meeting, it is discussed how they would all benefit from the next Thatcher book. But that's going to be pretty hard considering that Thatcher is going to be put to death tomorrow night. By the way, this is me. Coronet Books was a real publishing house, which was in operation at the time that this Batman story was published. Tor Books, T-O-R Books, was founded in April 1980, so just a couple months away. By the way, speaking of books being released after the author has died, remind me to tell you about V.C. Andrews. But back to the synopsis. We then see that one of these gentlemen is meeting with the Spook and wants to hire him to spring Thatcher out of jail. The Spook agrees to do it. The next workday is spent with Bruce and Lucius Fox as they discuss Thatcher's book and then leave the office when the bat signal blazes in the sky. Batman finds out from Commissioner Gordon that there has been a jailbreak from the penitentiary. And when Batman gets there, he is astonished to discover that instead of helping him, the guards are attacking him. You see, the Spook has a device that makes other people see Batman as Thatcher. The Spook then uses this device to make himself, the Spook, appear as Batman to take Batman, who appears as Thatcher, to his jail cell. Batman wakes up in the cell, realizes that everyone sees him as Thatcher, and convinces a guard to let him talk to Gordon because Batman can tell Jim things only they together know. The call does get through to Gordon, who has a heart attack as he begins to speak to Batman and is taken to intensive care.
Hate it when that happens.
Back in the cell, Batman gets the news about Jim, and then he gets a visit from the Spook. The visit doesn't cheer up Bruce at all because the Spook reveals that it was he who had Batman trapped and about to be sent to the electric chair. The Spook then blows up because it wasn't the Spook, but rather an elaborate balloon that explodes at Batman's touch. Yeah, I know that feeling. As Batman is led to the gallows, he uses some of the leftover explosive balloon material to evade the guards and slip out of the prison. He stops by Jim's house and they piece together that the Spook imitated Gordon so he could act like he had a heart attack and couldn't take Batman's call. While there, Batman sees Thatcher's book and solves the mystery. We will take a deep dive into the denouement of the story. Dave, what did you think of it?
This was actually a blast. I like the switches, and you're never going to hear me complain about Don Newton art. I didn't know the Spook very well. I've seen him in the background, but I've seen him in the Batcave Companion. This is the first story I've read with him.
Oh, cool.
He's actually kind of a cool villain. Goofy, but a lot of fun.
How about you, Paul?
Yeah, I thought it was good, too. We get Carrie Burkett's first appearance in Batman Family/Detective, and he's listed as, quote, guest writer, so that's interesting. We know that Denny O'Neill will be leaving DC shortly. He's still there, I believe. Great art, great one-and-done story. I have read a few Spook stories. I think he's kind of meh. This story's funny. He's got a device that sort of reminds me of the projector of the Island of a Thousand Thrills.
Yeah.
But This is one of a few that I thought was interesting. It reflects the current continuity of the time of Selina being Bruce's girlfriend, having given up the Catwoman identity that Len Wein was writing over in Batman. So I thought that was really neat. So overall, terrific. I really, really enjoyed it.
The two of you liked this a lot more than I did. I didn't hate it. I didn't think it was necessarily dumb. The first time, well, not the first time I read it, when I read it the first time for this, I actually forgot about, I don't want to call it a framing sequence, but that first part where it takes place in the airport, I kind of forgot that that was not a flat, well, I guess kind of a flashback.
Kind
from
of a
the
flashback,
book.
Yeah.
And I liked the way they did that. I thought that was really neat. I liked Selina. Well, and of course, yeah, the Don Newton art is great. So this definitely is Detective Comics, and we'll get into this. They go to the publisher and they go around the room. Each person is given a headshot and motive.
I don't think it's quite a fair play mystery, but the clue is there. Yeah. Batman makes a lot more of it than we might, but the clue is there. So it's close to a fair play mystery.
And there's at least one other story in this issue where it's kind of exactly the same thing. You can just see the camera going around to like each suspect.
Yeah, it's definitely intended to be that kind of story, which I like.
My kind of issue, I read comics and I enjoy comics, and comics are not a documentary. The Spook's little projector thing... I think I would have enjoyed this far more if that would have been explained better. My feeling was all of these people see Batman as Thatcher. Mm-hmm. Fine. Really? And I understand he may not want to risk his secret identity, but if it's a choice between my secret identity and my life, couldn't Batman just have taken off his cowl or even like his shirt? I'm not just saying that just takes off his shirt. If he would have taken off his cowl and his shirt, so then would the projector still work? Because they're not seeing Batman.
I was wondering, is it really a projector, Sean, or is it a hypnotism type thing?
I mean, I guess that makes more sense, but then how do you hypnotize?
I don't
almost
know.
To, if he would have sprayed him with some kind of powder or mist or something like that, then maybe I could understand that. Then did he spray himself so that they wouldn't see the Spook? So that's my contention with this story. And I guess I shouldn't hang everything.
I think they're overthinking it just a little bit.
Yeah.
Listen, remember how much we like the Island of a Thousand Thrills.
But then also where the Spook imitates Gordon so he can act like he has a heart attack because maybe Batman's gonna call. I know a couple issues ago, I was so impressed. The White Bat story, like where Batman says it's an impressive villain who digs a pit because he may need it. But this, he's imitating Gordon because maybe Batman will call and face a heart attack. Well, I'm laughing, so I must have enjoyed it.
Yeah. So I thought you would have liked how Batman uses his cape on pages 2 and 3, because he took his cape off and then he's without his cape. You love that kind of stuff.
It did kind of remind me of Robin's fake leg.
I know.
I'm going to hurl this on the other side of the thing and have it dangle down.
That's a little more believable. Like
I would have liked it better if it was a bat boot on the long pair of nylons going over the edge of the air controller tower.
Has anybody ever mentioned Batman's boots? If you look at them, the bottom, they're heeled. They're like cowboy boots. They're not treaded. They're heeled. How can that be? Like, how can he move in those?
Yeah, we talked about the boots one time on the show, and I don't think it was until Jim Lee's famous boot in the face cover where Batman started wearing these boots with treads and stuff on them. But these boots like this, Neil Adams drew them like that and Perro drew it like that. I don't know how that's supposed to not be slippery, to be honest with you.
Right.
They look like almost dress shoe soles. I agree with you, Dave.
Even though it's not said, I do think we can infer he would have different boots for different. If he knows he's going to the Arctic, his costume is going to be much more heavy. And if he knows he's going to be water skiing behind a train, he has boots that have a thicker tread. So that if they go down,
that's when we talked about it.
Maybe boots with ice skates in them.
Yeah. Double clap. And then when you talked about the cape, I thought you were going to say, I like how he scooped up the bits of the balloon with it. I did like that.
He uses his cape very effectively in this episode.
Yes. So I like that a lot. And then we get to the denouement, which is because he said a percentage of a percentage, that led him to know it was Desmond, who is the literary agent. Mm-hmm. And again, it is funny that, oh, we can't have another book by this guy because he's dead. In publishing, like the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, like they're not written by Franklin W. Dixon and you could even have inspired by Simon Thacker.
That's what I thought, as told to Simon.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I'm too close to the publishing world to separate myself.
So what I didn't know and I didn't recall about the spook, it's been a long time since I read any spook stories. I know he used a lot of gadgets. The use of this projector, as weird as it was, is at least consistent with his gadget usage. Page 16, the second to last page, is Batman is freeing Commissioner Gordon. He says, he impersonated you and faked your heart attack with his old suspended animation trick, slowing his pulse so it couldn't be detected. That definitely sounds like something he's done before, and I didn't recall what that was. Maybe some of our Bat listeners, Isamu, knock yourself out. Maybe we'll get another history of the spook like we did for Killer Moth. No, I'm just kidding, Isamu. Please don't.
That is not a call to action.
I mean, it sounded like a call to action to me, but
no.
I don't know if either of you guys heard about that. That caught my interest.
The spook for me is just when I see the spook, I know who the spook is. I think people probably always have characters like that who like you kind of know of, but you don't really interact with. I don't know if that's the right word. You read the Batman Encyclopedia, and even though you don't have firsthand knowledge of those issues, I think there are two different citations. And I guess if I was a better podcaster, I would have read them to get background, but I didn't.
Overall, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun story. You have to get over this image inducer gadget, but once you're over that, it's a pretty fun story. It puts Batman in an interesting position of having to avoid the electric chair. You know, that's an unusual thing.
I think there have been maybe one or two stories that we have covered that I just roll my eyes and was like a trudge through. And this was not that. I would not say this was a horrible story or I suffered my way through. Not at all. None of the stories in this issue are. Now, it wasn't rollicking weirdness that the Odd Man was.
It didn't go full Adam West Batman, but it skirted around it.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of those in these stories. Even some of the Denny O'Neill ones where it's just a little much. All right, if you guys are ready, we can move on.
Yes.
So now we're going to move on to the Bat Timeline. In this segment, we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month and what Batman Family was doing at that time. As always, thanks to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. And these were titles all published in November of 1979. So we're going to first start with the Bat books. But Sean, I wanted to make a special note. There are some general foods giveaways listed in Mike's Amazing World, of which Batman has a solo one. And there is one entitled Superheroes, which also has him on the cover. I don't really know anything about these. So if any Bat cousin knows more, please let us know in the comments. Anyway, Sean, kick us off with the regular Bat books.
Okay, Batman 320 with an awesome Bernie Wrightson cover, The Curse of the Inquisitor by Denny O'Neill and Irv Novik. If you don't know what this issue is, you do know what this issue is when you see it. It's got a super, super close-up of Batman's face, and he's in shock or awe. Coming down the hallway behind him is, I guess, the Inquisitor. But it's great because there's an arrow that's coming like right by like his eye. It's a great cover. When you see it, you'll remember it.
And then in Brave and the Bold, number 159, Batman and Ra's al Ghul, Master of Assassins, continues the League of Assassins storyline a bit by Denny O'Neill and Jim Aparo. I really like the Ra's al Ghul logo on the cover. Yeah, Batman ripping off the poster saying Ra's al Ghul is wanted for crimes against humanity. In his logo, it says Ra's al Ghul and then Master of the Assassins in big font. So, yeah. I really thought that was cool.
The next one is Justice League of America number 175. And this has Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman kind of in the back. And then this huge purple gargoyle dinosaur dragon thing coming after this little kid. And Red Tornado is swirling in and he says, the creature is beyond our control. This boy is doomed. The next one is Super Friends number 29, and it is Invisible Defenders of Earth. And this is a fantastic cover. All five of the Super Friends, but all of their flesh is invisible ghost. Wonder Woman has her magic lasso, and she's lassoing all the male members of the group. And it says, Wonder Woman, why are you making us disappear? And she says, because our survival and Earth's depends on it. So that's like a really great cover.
And then the last Bat book this month, of course, is World's Finest, number 261. Terrific Rich Buckler cover. The story is called Showdown in Gotham City, where the World's Finest duo is taking on the very intimidating team of the Penguin and Terra Man. Wow, that's awesome. We also get Black Lightning, who's going to be coming our way real soon, Captain Marvel, Shazam, and a Green Arrow Black Canary team up.
Yeah, the late 70s, they were really trying to make Terra Man happen.
Yeah. Dave, tell us what was on your pull list or what you might have gotten or wanted to get at this time.
Ooh, I was too wee to actually be reading. Well, I was just starting, so. But definitely looking back, Green Lantern, number 125.
Okay.
If you look at that, is a Denny O'Neil and Joe Staten issue. Joe Staten's Green Lantern is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I can't underscore that enough. DC Comics Presents, because it's Zatanna. It looks like the weird, goofy Zatanna. We're like, we're kind of try to push her as a superhero, but
going
to take.
This is before the George Perez redesign.
Exactly, yeah.
I hate that costume.
The one with the snake on the head, yeah. As much as I love George Perez.
No.
Oh, the one we're talking about here.
It's a body stocking.
It's not a costume.
A body stocking and cape?
I don't hate it. I just think it's boring.
And I understand it's in honor of, is it Cindela, her mother?
Yeah, but that's why she did it, but it's silly.
Yeah. Doesn't mean we have to like it. Right, it's good for her. And then lastly, I would say The Flash 282, just because I'm a sucker for The Flash. And that is a Ross Andrew cover. It is gorgeous.
Yeah, and there he's fighting Green Lantern on that, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, using his yellow boots as a weakness. Yeah.
Yes.
Love it.
And of course, the Bat books we're talking about already.
Absolutely. John, how about you? What do you got going on?
Oh, buckle in. So, of course, we have Adventure Comics, which is Starman and Plastic Man. And I actually had this issue. At the time, I had no idea what a whirling dervish really is. This was my introduction to the term whirling dervish. So I don't know that I certainly understood that Plastic Man is a funny strip, but I don't know. Well, I didn't know that that whirling dervish was a pun on what a whirling dervish is. The next one is Archie Giant Series Magazine number 488, Archie Giant Series Magazine number 489, Archie Giant Series Magazine number 490, Archie Giant Series Magazine number 491, because this is Archie's Christmas Stocking, Betty and Veronica's Christmas Spectacular, Archie's Christmas Love-In, and Sabrina's Christmas Magic.
Sean, I want to point out, Richie's got nothing on Archie this month. I count them. There are 26 Archie titles this month. Now, not all about Archie, but most of them had a Christmas theme. Wow, 26.
So I love Christmas comics. I think my story is similar, where when you went to the newsstand, you would get your DC, you would get your Marvel. Then if you had leftover money, then you would branch out into whatever, into Archie or Harvey or Gold Key or Dell or whatever. But with Christmas comics, I was more likely to not have to wait to branch out. My next one is Fun and Games Magazine, Marvel Fun and Games Magazine. And we're already up to issue number 6. And that is great. It's Dr. Doom, and he's working on a word search puzzle. So it's fantastic. I love that. The next one is The New Adventures of Superboy, number 2. And it's a great cover because there's this odd statue, multi-faced statue, and Superboy is on fire. And he says, Lana, I'm bursting into flames. How could that happen? And Lana's pointing at this fantastic figure. It's someone in a suit, but he has a demon head on, like a devil head. The evil statue did it, Superboy. And now it's turning my father into a demon. My next one, of course, I am legally obligated to call out Spider-Woman number 23 because I want my reprints. And it's The Mysterious Spider-Woman Betrayed. And it's cool because it has, I guess, the Gamesman. The story is called Enter the Gamesman. So I'm going to guess this is the Gamesman. And he has a gun and he's shooting out Count Vertigo circles or Aquaman telepathic circles. Then, of course, Time Warp number 3. We're halfway through the run of Time Warp. 8 stories. There's this horrific cover where there's this insect alien thing grabbing a woman astronaut. Ugh.
That's Mike Kaluta, man. That's a striking cover, though.
Now, I talked about branching out into Archie, Dell, all of those kind of things, and I'm actually gonna get a Gold Key comic.
What?
I am fully aware this is gonna be a horrible issue on really weird paper, but I have to because it is Walt Disney Showcase number 54 with The Black Hole.
I thought you get that one.
So I'm going to be honest and confess, Bat Cousins, when I was a kid, we didn't go to the movies often. Ever since Robin Hood, we did see every Disney animated movie, but I wanted to go to every movie and we didn't. So a lot of times in school, when the kids would be talking about the movie, oh yeah, I went this weekend. I saw, my mom and dad took me. Yeah, I went with my sister. Yeah. A lot of times I would lie and tell people that I saw the movie because I wanted them to think I was cool.
So this is your secret origin of why you love movies so much.
Yeah, it totally could be. Yeah. So my sister and brother-in-law, when they were dating, would take us to movies. So could you imagine going out on a date and having to take, you know, your sisters and brothers and sisters? I saw the Witch Mountain movies. So there were some, but I never saw Black Hole when it was in the theater, and it looked spectacular. So the kids in school were like, yeah, when that one robot went around the corner, I totally saw the wires. And I'm like, yeah, me too. I'm glad you talked about that. But it wasn't because I didn't see the wires because I didn't see the movie. So I do have to confess that. I'm sorry.
You did eventually see the black hole though, right?
I own it on DVD and now Blu-ray. And I don't necessarily think that I love it as a movie going experience, but I love it for what it is. And certainly some of the special effects I think are still fantastic and hold up. And that's it for all of my picks.
All right. So for me, a couple things you guys didn't talk about. First of all, I have to say, I would run for the hills rather than buy Happy Days number 6, which has a giant picture of Ron Howard's face on the cover. Yikes. Yikes. Even Fonzie on the side can't make this cover cool enough for me to want to buy it. The other one I really want to point out is Night Music number 1. So this was the opera comic that we talked about with Craig Russell.
Oh, yeah. And
I never actually seen it. I've seen the collection. I don't have any of them, but I just happened to notice that that came out this time, so I thought I'd call it out. Significant issue that came out this month as well, Savage She-Hulk number 1, first appearance, written by Stan Lee with art by John Buscema, of course. And then X-Men 130 had the first appearance of the Dazzler. So This was right before I started getting the X-Men. So I haven't quite got to the point where I'm buying it, but I quickly got a bunch of back issues, so I knew I had that one. But, first appearance of the Dazzler, X-Men number 130.
So I swear this is true. I did have Savage She-Hulk number 1. I did. I'm not just saying that. Like I said, I went to see the black hole. I really did have that issue. I promise. I swear.
It's like you're going to have to clarify everything from now on.
I know. But of course, we're not done at the newsstand because, as Paul alluded to, we have to give our Richie Rich count. So there are 14 Richie Rich cover books. Now, maybe he was in a back issue of some Harvey title. We don't know that. But he is in 14 books. These books were on sale for November in 1979. So maybe Harvey put more books out thinking they were stocking stuffers, that kind of thing. I saw that one of these is a digest called Richie Rich Best of the Years, number 5. So I did a little research. So there are 6 Best of the Years Richie Rich digests. I looked on eBay and the cheapest one at $4 was number 1. So I bought that this morning. This is really true. I'm not just saying this to get in with the cool kids, but I really did purchase number 1. It should be here in a week and a half. Now, I don't think it's going to be a trade paperback curated edition of this was his first appearance. This is where Dollar first appeared. This is Irona's. It's probably just whatever 18 stories that will fit in this page count. But I'm holding out hope. And I need more Harvey digests.
We all do, right?
Yes.
Okay. You know, I bet there's a lot of newsstands in Gotham City.
I bet there are.
So that gives us a nice segue to our next story, which is a tale of Gotham City. And it is The Last Duty. It is 8 pages, written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Johnny Craig, inked by Johnny Craig, reprinted never. After 25 years of being a subway cop, Clem Schenectady has reached the day of retirement. After numerous mentions of how he's never stopped a crime, never seen a crook, and never pulled his gun, we learn that Andre Skinsky is trying to leave the U.S. after stealing some top secret papers from the U.N. After his co-worker informs him that the train lights will go out for about 30 seconds when they enter the river tunnel, the subway train takes off. During the ride, Clem interacts with a woman on her way to the airport and a disciple of the Church of Brother Blood. Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, the Church of the Final Apocalypse. Just as the train is about to enter the river tunnel, Clem receives word that Skinsky is on board his train and that he is disguised as a... At that point, the lights go out and the walkie-talkie goes to static. When the lights come back on, the woman is gone and right above her seat is an open window. The disciple says that the lady must have jumped out of the window, but Clem has seen the original Superman movie so often, he knows that there's not much room to maneuver down in the subway tunnel and instead figures out that the woman was actually a man in disguise and he hid under the subway seat, but in reality, he switched disguises with Skinsky, who was dressed up as the woman, but is now disguised as the disciple. Skinsky tries to pull a gun to escape, but Clem stops him, but not by pulling his gun. Oh no, he doesn't want to spoil his 25-year streak on his last day. What did you think, David?
I laughed at this too much. I have to admit, I'm sorry. Like the first splash page is our guy walking down the street. And I kept thinking of the Chappelle Show bit. Calvin's got a job. I couldn't. It might be just because I was about to go to sleep. I'm reading this at night, and I'm like, oh, The Last Duty. They said duty.
I know.
I'm nothing if not mature. But when I went back through it, I'm like, it's just that shy of being kind of a captivating story until you realize, much like the last one for you, Sean, it doesn't make any sense. The logistics don't add up. Was the short already there? Was that part of the plan? There's too many questions for me.
I thought it was a nice little story. But again, to Paul Levitz, who asked for this? I liked it fine. But how about Man Bat? Right. The art is nice, kind of slice of life art. Clem looks like a real beat cop. The newspaper, that's sort of a Chekhov's newspaper. I did like the ending. I thought it was cute that he stopped it without using his gun. I thought that was neat. A lot to do to change all that, all the clothes and get under the seat and do all that business in 30 seconds when the lights are out and there's no light.
Yeah.
So that's a little much to believe. I thought it was cute, but a bit forgettable.
So first of all, I love the idea of Tales of Gotham City. Like, I think that's an interesting premise. It really would have worked more in Batman Family, but Detective is fine. I will almost defend the idea of the switch, because it does mention that they were going to switch at the airport.
Yeah, they did say that.
Mm.
But then the problem is they decided instead of switching at the airport, they'll do it in the subway tunnel where they have 30 seconds.
And it's pitch dark.
And did the New York subway system at this time have seats that can just raise and have this storage space? That's my kind of... The next thing, which could be... I don't know if it's controversial or not. I say things and I don't think anything of them. And then I find out that there's this brouhaha. We talk about artists, and art is art. It's subjective. Certain artists you like, certain artists you don't like. I know that this artist is Johnny Craig, who I don't know who that is.
Well, he's an old time golden age guy. He's getting long in the tooth at this point.
But it reminds me of Dan Spiegel.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not a fan of Dan Spiegel.
Well, we're going to get him on some of these stories coming up.
I know. Bat Cousins, you can make me sit at my own table at the reunion if I have to. I do like Dan Spiegel better than Don Heck, but it's one rung away. Don Heck, I think of as cardboard cutouts. That is exactly what that art looks like to me. And a lot of Dan Spiegel, it just looks so flat. And I understand I'm looking at a comic book page, but we talk about motion and sense of placement and that kind of thing. And the art for this just does not do it for me at all. They're on a subway, which has motion. The top of page 5, you have the subway entering the tunnel. And there are speed lines and everything, but my eye just sees it as a flat image. At the end, when Clem slams the guy's hand into the pole, it looks like it's just flat up again. I don't see that motion. And I don't know what the difference is. I don't know if it's the inking. I don't know if it's just, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's taste. I like it better than you did. Tend to like Dan Spiegel a little bit more. I mean, he did a lot of non-superhero stuff.
One thing I will stick up for it, I do really like anthology shows. Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I like those. You're in, you're out. Sometimes they're predictable. I don't mind at all that it's some one-off character. I'm fine with that. And even the story, I think, is okay. It just comes down to the art that's disappointing for me.
I like the concept of living in a city where there's disasters by clowns, a bat vigilante. This could have been in anything, though. This could have been in a Richie Rich comic, for example. Shoehorn Richie in there and it's fine.
You could have seen the butler disarm the guy.
There you go. Yep, exactly.
Cadbury. I hope I get Cadbury's first appearance in my best of the years.
All right, I think we'll move on to our third story, starring, of course, Batgirl. It is entitled The Leader of the Dark Lords, a 10-pager by Jack C. Harris, with art by Rob Kelly's favorite instructor at the Kubert School, Jose Delbo.
Rob Kelly went to the Kubert School?
Believe it or not, I think he did.
He's never mentioned that.
Speaking ill of the dead.
I know. Inked by Frank Schiramonte. Batgirl is annoyed. Our favorite former congresswoman is back in Gotham and trying out her new cycle, but can't take her mind off her election defeat. But running into the middle of a gang war will get your attention. She stops some gang members who were trying to eviscerate Len Rockwell, the leader of the street gang named the Invaders. No, not those guys. Turns out his opposite number, the leader of the Dark Lords, was killed last night while on enemy turf. Len has been arrested for the murder, but was freed for lack of evidence. Babs decides to check the police file on the murder and bumps into her dad at GCPD HQ. He gives her some fatherly advice about leadership. And then Batgirl has another Jack C. Harris aha. Babs confronts the two gangs about to rumble. The number two guy of the Dark Lords, Salgato, lets slip that his predecessor had been knifed, but Batgirl intervenes and tells both sides that Salgato murdered his own leader and tried to pin it on the invaders. No, not those guys. She talks both sides down as the police come to take the murderer away. The end. Dave, what'd you think of the leader of the Dark Lords?
I really enjoyed this one a lot. I immediately went to the Warriors and I had to double check real quick if the movie had been released, but yes, it had. Somebody came out to play. I like that they got rid of the stupid collar on Batgirl's costume.
Yeah.
It's such a great costume until you throw that collar on there.
That was a Don Heck special right there.
Yeah. I like the way that the killer tipped himself off. I like Gordon and Bob's having that conversation. This was great until you get to the last panel. I don't think a father and daughter stand like that. That was a little... That's an awkward pose. It's a little awkward.
Now that's in my head, man.
I don't think that's horrible. That's not.
Could be worse, but no, this was, I really did enjoy this. This was the standout as I was reading through, but I'm a sucker for Batgirl.
Yeah, no, Batgirl's great. Sean, how about you? What do you think?
So I'm actually going to give this two grades. The story starting on page two until the end, I would give like a 7 or an 8. I liked it. Much like we say the Razakis recap, I think we have to say the Jack C. Harris comment. The C for Jack C. Harris, I think, stands for comment, because so often in his stories, someone says a comment and it makes the hero think, oh, yeah. No, I know the end of this mystery.
That's like the third time he's used that technique in 3 months. It's crazy.
And I think we have another one coming up. But I like it in mysteries where the bad guy reveals too much because the bad guy was there at the crime. Mm-hmm. So that trope, I know it is a trope, but I like that trope a lot. The actual story, I think, is good. I really liked it. It's street level. I think that's cool. And it's even kind of like Batgirl being a little bit, not dangerous and not skirting the law, but she's kind of letting these gangs, I don't want to say have their run of the streets, but they are protecting the people in their neighborhood. It's kind of interesting that Batgirl's not taking them all in.
Yeah. So
my two comments, one is a super huge complaint. My complaint is they make so little of Batgirl losing the election.
Yeah, you'd think we would have got something more than that.
Yeah, so it's a comment in the first page, oh, I'm going to be out all night busting a crime. And then a comment in the last page when she says, oh, you know, I'm going to run for re-election.
I don't think she actually does. Don't worry.
Yeah. I just think more should have been made of that. And I understand you're not going to have 10 pages of Batgirl sitting in her apartment saying, oh, I wish I would have won the election. First of all, I think it should have started out somewhere like at her office or something, like clearing out.
She could have been
like
walking out of the Capitol building with a cardboard box.
Yeah, something more should have been made of that. So my other thing, David, you said the very last panel was very confusing to you. The panel for me was page 6. Commissioner Gordon and Batgirl are in the file cabinet office. They're walking down the hall, and then Batgirl gets on her motorcycle. I really thought, is Batgirl riding her motorcycle out of this room? So the third panel from the bottom, they're still in that room.
Yeah, they're in the file room in the third panel.
The next one, they're wherever.
Well, you do see, but look at the next one. Above Babs's head, you see bricks. So I'm thinking at that point, they might have just gone out the door and the bricks are the outside of the door. Okay, I'm just guessing. I agree with you. It's funny the way it's laid out and it's not obvious, but I think maybe that's a clue that they've exited the building.
Okay.
I enjoyed it okay. I'm not sure I enjoyed it as much as you guys. I liked it. I thought the gang action was a little watered down, but it was okay. I did like the twist. The Gordons don't quit. We've gotten that lecture from him 2 or 3 issues in a row for her. I thought it was funny that when she confronts the gang leader, she comes down the bat pole on page 7. Then she climbs back up the bat pole to get out. I thought that was a little weird. And overall, the art I thought was okay, but I thought it was a little lackluster. The last point I have to make is, and I'm sure this is something we'll hear from Brett about, if you look at the last page, Gordon lives in a gigantic house.
Yes.
With a huge lawn and trees all around. I mean, Gordon lives, the police commissioner job must pay pretty well.
It's like the governor's mansion.
I was just going to say, it's almost like Gracie Mansion in a way. So maybe Gotham is set up that the commissioner gets a house like that too.
Got me.
It would almost have to be.
But yeah, I don't know that we need to go beat by beat. I mean, Dave, do you have any other points you want to make on the story? It's a pretty straightforward
story. I think we hit them all. Yeah.
your quote-unquote reading of that line, Dave, was fantastic. I know you weren't reading from the script, but that was great. Well, perhaps Commissioner Gordon could afford a house like that because maybe he is in the advertising agency. Maybe he's in the advertising game, which takes us to bat branding, which are the ads, the letter pages, all of those kind of things in this issue. And boy, howdy, we have a fantastic one to kick it off. Don't let Lois Lane find out you're a friend of Superman. Because there's a whole bunch of vehicles parked in the Daily Planet parking lot, including a big semi-tractor trailer with the huge Daily Planet Superman Saves the World headline with Clark Kent changing into Superman.
I know, I love that. It's given away on the paper delivery truck. I think that's hysterical.
Then you have like a black van. So you know how vans of the 70s would have a sci-fi scene airbrushed on the side? Well, this one has Superman, which that's fantastic. The next one is a Metropolis squad car, a Daily Planet helicopter. And the only reason we want that Daily Planet helicopter is so we can recreate, probably, I'm willing to say, I think that is the best cinematic superhero moment ever. And I love Avengers Assemble. Like right now talking about it, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about Captain America catching the hammer. I love that. I think Who's Got You is probably the best.
You've got me. Who's got you?
Yeah, I think that is the best scene in any superhero movie ever. And then also parked beside that is the Supermobile. Yay. I swear this part is true. I am not saying this to get in with the cool kids of this episode. I had the red one, the Daily Planet with the Superman saves. I did have that. Yes.
Oh, cool.
I swear. I promise. I would have rather have had the Supermobile, which I didn't have, but I did have the...
Did you put it in your pocket like this kid?
I take them wherever I go. Well, funny you should say. So we zoom these, and as I said that, I stood up and put my hand in my pocket, which would have been fantastically spectacular. But no, I don't still have it.
There was a local person to me that had an actual van where he painted Superman on the side. He had basically recreated that corgi.
Oh wow, that's cast. Pretty neat.
I mean, eventually it died out, but yeah, I would see it driving around. I'm like, that's my guy. Never met him.
Oh wow,
I wanted, because I figured we'd be best friends.
Anytime I see that black Superman van, it always makes me think of 5 years ago, 10 years ago from this issue, when they had the superhero stickers and they had the superhero stickers on the car. Oh my God, I would love that.
Now that would have been cool.
Okay, our next one is a Hawkman hostess ad, and it is Hawkman makes a safe landing. Now, last time we talked about the Twinkies not being part of the plot, and the same thing here. The guy's jumping out of an airplane and his chute doesn't open. So Hawkman swoops in, and not only does he save the man, but he saves the hostess cupcakes.
I love how this guy's got him just in his pack on his chest. I just thought that was super funny.
If I was Hawkman and I knew that there were hostess fruit pies in that satchel, I'm not saying I would have let the guy fall, but I probably wouldn't have worked so hard to save him. But these are Hostess cupcakes, and Hostess cupcakes are good. So
yes.
Next ad is the center spread of the issue. And we don't have a Saturday morning TV ad. We have a Star Wars toy spread, which is really cool. It says, now from the greatest movie of all time comes the Kenner Star Wars toy collection. You got the Imperial Troop Transporter. You got a radio-controlled R2-D2. A creature cantina, and a whole lineup of a bunch of action figures and diecast vehicles. Just a cool ad that you could see the kids of this age pouring over this center spread without question. I don't know. Did you have many of these toys, Dave?
Unfortunately, no.
Yeah, because you were pretty young at this age.
I was young, yeah. So most of the toys would have come from the Empire wave. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
these are the, I guess it's serious. I mean, I'm sure we'll get comments aplenty from Chris and others on the vintage aspect of these toys and which ones are the most difficult to get. But they've got a collector's case, which is cool. And I had something like that. I remember a plastic case that I put figures in. And I don't remember if it was a Star Wars one or a superhero one. I can't remember, but it's probably before this one. So it probably wasn't Star Wars. I just don't remember. But yeah, some cool stuff there.
So I have an amazing confession. I had never seen the first three Star Wars movies until they were re-released in their special editions.
Oh, wow.
Now, I will say,
you got to hand in your geek card, man.
I know. So when I was in fourth grade, I had, I don't know, is it called the Star Wars Storybook? It's a paperback and it has C-3PO and R2-D2 on the cover and it tells the story of Star Wars. It has text, but then it's also like a ton of pictures. So like I knew the story and I actually did have C-3PO. I'm not sure how or why, but I had C-3PO. And to this day, C-3PO is my absolute very favorite Star Wars character.
Because your head looks like him.
Oh, that is true. That is true. Although I could cosplay as him. That's good. Now, I'm almost positive I have this correct. So up in the corner, the new Star Wars Imperial Troop Transporter. That was a toy that was made just for the toy line, but then shows up in The Mandalorian.
Mm-hmm. Exactly correct. Yeah.
All of my bat cousins who are, you can...
It was there for fan service specifically because it was a toy and never in the movies.
All right.
Nicely done, both of you guys. The next ad, real quick, is right after the Batgirl story. We have the Mego introduces elastic Superman and Batman figures. And it's a hysterical ad of Superman and Batman bendable, stretchable figures with their arms and legs wrapped around themselves. I'll definitely include this in the show notes because I just think that's a funny looking ad. But it's now your favorite superheroes are elastic. So you can bend them, stretch, twist them, and stretch them anywhere you like. I guess Mego people were trying to stretch their product line.
Well, Stretch Armstrong. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you guys have these?
I did not.
No.
I had six of each of these and 12 stretch. No, I'm lying. I didn't have any. I wanted them. I coveted them, but I don't know. And Max, did they make a Plastic Man? They would have had to have made a Plastic Man, but why?
You would think.
I would think.
But they didn't.
Did they not? Oh, man.
Not on that, no.
That doesn't make sense to me.
Which is insulting. Yeah, I'm a little upset about that.
That don't sit right with me. The next one, oh, man, is a two-page ad, beautifully illustrated, and it is for the movie 1941. I did a little bit of research. A couple years ago, during the pandemic, I did a watch-through of every Steven Spielberg movie that I had never seen before. And 1941 was included in that. And I thought 1941 was a bomb. But in my research just earlier today, 1941 actually was not a bomb. It did okay commercially. It's just that coming off of Jaws and... So not Raiders, because... Raiders
isn't yet. Yeah, Raiders is...
Close Encounters. Coming off of Jaws and Close Encounters, this did much, much less, both financially and critically. And the weird thing is, it's a comedy right after Pearl Harbor is bombed. California was on high alert. And it's a comedy about that time.
I've never seen it.
I actually think you have to watch 1941 twice. It definitely makes a difference when you quote unquote know a movie isn't good and you watch it because you don't have like that high expectation. I knew it wasn't good. So I watched it the first time. It kind of wasn't good. But I did watch it a second time and I did appreciate it more. Now, I will not say it's a good movie. But when you know what it is going in, first of all, it's a 2-hour comedy and it's really, really rare that you get a good 2-hour comedy. But the special effects are great. It's a little scattershot because vignette here, vignette here, vignette here. There's a fantastic dance floor Zoot Suit Riot scene. That's fantastic. Dumbo is in it, so that's neat. I definitely would say if you're interested in watching this, watch it. Don't let the bad publicity around it stop you from watching it. Okay, now we are going to move on to the Batcave, which is the letters page. And as always, we are going to invite Charles D. Brown from Brentwood, New York, Bradley A. Ross from Ballasinwin, Pennsylvania.
Ballakinwood. It's actually outside Philly.
Oh, okay. Marianne Hauser from Warner Robins, Georgia. Kent A. Fennis from Greenwood, Indiana. David Shore from Tacoma, Washington. And Bruce Finley from Birmingham, Alabama. Please come on the show if you are listening to us. Even if we make fun of your letter, you can come on and take us to task for it. I have a couple of things that I'm going to point out. The one I'll save for last, which is the funniest one. A lot of letters about Batwoman. Most all of them are saying what we're saying. It's, you shouldn't have killed her off. A few people are a little bit more lenient and want to see what happens. Kent says, after all, Batgirl developed a very close friendship with Kathy these past few years, and I can hardly believe that she would not want to get actively involved and bring Kathy's murderers to justice.
Yeah, excellent point.
Exactly what we were saying. This only affected Batman, which was ridiculous.
That's the one sentence that I pulled out that I thought was the best sentence of the page, too.
Well, it may not be the best sentence because the following sentence says, also, since the sensei is involved, I hope the dead man will make an appearance. You're right. And then kind of along that line, David Shore said, Man-Bat was really shaping up. Pity you dropped it. Much potential there. Yes. And then he goes on to say, may I suggest rotating stories that might be in two or three parts and star such characters as Man-Bat, Phantom Stranger, Demon, Mr. Miracle, and other Batman family members. In the Comic Reader a while back, it was said that Steve Englehart was going to do a full-length story in Batman Family starring the whole cast of that book. Whatever became of that story?
Yeah, I saw that too. I was like,
then they go on to say the full-lengther seems to have vanished with Steve when he went to the coast to finish his novel. Oh,
yeah, that's a bummer. Sad. Yeah, by the time he came back to comics, there was no more dollar comics.
Yeah. So I have two more things to say. If you were reading the letters pages backwards, you would have seen in the last letter, they mistyped or misspelled Man-Bat because there's no hyphen. It's all just one. It's Man-Bat. It's not Man-Bat. Now, the last comment I have is Paul Levitz has a little text piece at the front about his decision about Batwoman. So I'm assuming Paul Levitz is the person who assembled this letter column. I'm also assuming Paul Levitz doesn't know French because Charles D. Brown says, with so much concentration on the menage a trois between Batman, Talia, and Ra's al Ghul, I kind of think people did not know what a menage a trois was. I don't think Charles knew. I don't think Paul knew. I don't think DC Comics knew what a menage a trois is between these characters. Oh, heavens.
All right, on that note.
Segue out of that, yeah.
Charles, I do still want you on the show.
We're going to go to another stretchy guy, the Elongated Man, making his, I won't say debut in Detective Comics, because he certainly belongs in Detective, because he was at a backup feature for a number of years in Detective. His return, I suppose, to Detective. And he is in a story entitled Minus One Miracle Car, a six-pager written by newcomer to our podcast, Mike W. Barr, with art by Ed Barreto and Joe Chiella. And this has never been reprinted as far as I can tell. So Ralph and Sue Dibny are on hand at the unveiling of a new Miracle Car. This car solves the energy crisis by running on garbage. Now, all we need is a flux capacitor and we'll be all set. But anyway, during the test run for the audience, the lights go out for a moment. And when they come back on, the car is gone. Maybe the car is under the seat of the subway. No, no, no. That starts old Ralph's nose a wiggling for sure. I'll spare you the details, but we do get several suspects, all of whom are named, Sean,
yes,
including the owner, the designer, the security chief, and the driver. The ductile detective does get to stretch himself into a tire to avoid an electrical shock, which is kind of more like something I would see Plastic Marin doing, but I digress. Sue, once again, proves herself the brains of the operation as she notices the tire marks are much lighter up on the track than they are down in the garage. Then the stretchable sleuth sees a tape recorder and realizes what's going on. Turns out there was a set of double culprits, as the driver and the designer were both in on it. The designer had stolen the plans from a competing company. He figured by staging the theft, he could accuse them of stealing his plans instead of the other way around. But how did the car disappear? Well, it was never actually there. The driver had a collapsible frame with a fake car body on it and a cassette tape of the screeching tires. In the darkness, he just collapsed the car and no one was the wiser. Kind of reminded me of Batman pulling a rubber mask off his cowl. Phew! A lot happened in these six pages. What did you guys think?
It was ridiculous. And not necessarily in a good way. You like a lot of twists and turns in a mystery story. This had them, but they didn't make an ounce of sense. Putting this car in the subway seat makes more sense than, like, here's a magic trick, but we're trying not to get caught stealing. Also, I didn't remember Elongated Man's costume having that V-neck.
Oh, I do.
I've seen some artists draw it like that. I think that's an artistic license, but it doesn't always come look like that. But I hear you on that.
You just put that gold chain on.
Yeah.
Big medallion.
I thought the art, Ed Barreto, I usually really like, but I thought this was kind of yuck. I don't know about you guys.
It was very flat, to use Sean's term. It was, there's nothing vibrant about it.
How about you, Sean? What are your thoughts? I don't know that we need to go beat by beat on this.
Yeah, we're not. So I like Elongated Man.
Yeah.
We talk about reprints and stuff, and generally the only kind of reprints I get is when they are reprinted how they were. So I'm not a big fan of black and white reprints unless they were in black and white. So those Showcase, I only have two of them. I have Batgirl and have Elongated Man, and the only reason I got them is because they were $5 each.
You used to be able to get them at shows for cheap, and I got a whole bunch of them. My kids would read them on the beach and stuff like that.
That's the only way I would buy Showcase. I don't like if it was originally in color and it's reprinted in black and white. I don't like it. All that to say, I do like Elongated Man. This story, kind of like you said, I think the art is kind of horrible. I think the only time Ralph looks like Ralph is on page 3 when he's going to go into like the spray painting thing.
Yeah, he looks a little more like Ralph there. I agree with that.
I actually do love where he's in the tire. I like when Elongated Man just kind of stretch himself out. There's sometimes over the course of his publishing history, maybe like 3 times where like he turns into a vase or stuff. And I don't like
that. That's a Plastic Man thing. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I don't like that. Apparently, I learned italicize cars and paint so that paint sticks. And if that's true, I think that's a cool fact that I learned. But yeah, I think that's the only good things about this story. Kind of like you said, Elongated Man belongs in Detective Comics. That absolutely is fine. I have no issues with that at all.
But I had 3 notes. 1, confusing. 2, art, yuck. And 3, Ralph has a terrible haircut in this story.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But I will say, and this segues into our next segment, this story, guys, was actually retold in issue number 3 of The Maze Agency, The Case of the Vanishing Vehicle. And Mike W. Marr mentions in the letters page of that comic that he was very unhappy with the way that Elongated Man's story came out. And so he rewrote it to be a fair play mystery in The Maze Agency. So we talked about it quite a bit when we did that podcast on FW Presents. And his primary objection was that this 6-page story was too short, and he felt like he could do it right in 26 pages. So I just wanted to point that out, because Bat Family, this month we are going to do our Bat Family history on Mike W. Barr. There are a bunch of sources that we'll include in the show notes, as well as another DC profile in the gallery. But I'm happy to announce that Mike W. Barr was the runaway winner in our Patreon poll, who to be covered, with 61% of the votes. I had put out a question to our Patreon. I gave him the choice of Mike W. Barr, Dick Giordano, and Jack C. Harris. And Mike W. Barr had 61% of the vote. Dick Giordano, a distant second at 29%, where poor Jack C. Harris only had a mere 10% of the vote. And you know, Dick has a whole Tomorrow's book about him, so my guess is I won't do him, but I'm not sure we'll ever get to Jack C. Harris, but we'll see. Just to be transparent to our listeners, we did a mini Mike W. Barr profile on that episode that Shag, Siskoin, and I did on The Maze Agency from, you know, a number of months ago, so check it out if you haven't listened to it. Anyway, now all that to say, we're going to get to Mike W. Barr, who was born in 1952, and he was a regular letter column writer in the late 60s into the early 70s. His first published work was 1973, a short story to Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. That story was about a whodunit at a comic book convention, which he also recycled that idea into a Maze Agency story later as well. He then sold 2 Elongated Man stories to Julie Schwartz in 1974, and those were his comic debuts in Detective 444 and 453, so quite a while ago. He had a few miscellaneous other credits, as well as some text features for Marvel's Black and White magazines, and for our favorite, Amazing World of DC Comics. But his dream came true in 1977, as he was hired as DC's proofreader. I am sure he read every comic backwards, Sean. By mid-1980, he was writing regularly for both DC and Marvel, and in 1981, penned stories for Marvel Team-Up and Mystery in Space and Star Trek, where he created the Native American character Ensign Bearclaw and a pacifist Klingon named Conum. And I remember reading those stories when they came out. In 1981, he took on a bigger staff position at DC as an editor, and he remained there as an editor until 1987. And highlights from his time at DC include Camelot 3000, of course, with Brian Bolland from 1982 to 84, which was one of DC's first direct market-only titles. The first Green Arrow limited series with Trevor Von Eden, 1983. And there's a great article about that series in back issue number 137. Several issues of The Brave and Bold, including number 200. And then, of course, right after number 200, Batman and the Outsiders with Jim Aparo. He co-created a bunch of heroes that are still around today, movie stars even. Halo, Katana, Geo-Force, and even later, Looker, and a bunch of villains like the Force of July and the Nuclear Family, who were also TV stars. Concurrently, he was writing DC's Star Trek title for a number of issues up to number 16. 1987 was a big year for Mike. Batman Year 2 with Todd McFarlane and Alan Davis in Detective Comics in 1987. The Reaper returned later in the graphic novel Batman Full Circle. And of course, the plot inspired the best Batman movie of all, Batman Mask of the Phantasm. Batman's Son of the Demon original graphic novel with Jerry Bingham also came out in 1987. So we have him and later Grant Morrison to thank for Damian. This hardcover book helped propel DC back to first place in the sales chart for the first time in many years. So that month they were first in the sales chart. In 89 to 90, he wrote DC's version of Doc Savage, including his first ever team up with the Shadow. Mike's big creator-owned title was, of course, the Fair Play Whodunit series, The Maze Agency, which he designed with Alan Davis, but introduced with new talent, Adam Hughes. This title ran for a few publishers from 1988 to 91, with a couple other relaunches in 97 and 2005. And I'm happy to say, I haven't seen it yet, but the Scout Comics recently published a new Maze Agency number one. I think number one is the only one on sale at this time. Again, listen to that episode of FW Presents if you want more Maze Agency. He's written for animation with episodes of Young Justice, Beware the Batman, and the Lego DC Superhero Girls, Supervillain High. He likes to say, and the Simon & Schuster website concurs, that he was the first person to write stories for all four free streaming incarnations of Star Trek in one form or another. It's a neat factoid. And his most recent comic work prior to this reboot of the Maze Agency was a Katana six-part story in Suicide Squad Black Files in 2019. He's still with us today. A Mike's Amazing World shows 488 story credits, and I'm not sure all his independent work is represented there, so that's still a big body of work. There's a cool article about him and Adam Hughes in back issue number 2, because their editor on that comic was Mike Urie, who is the editor of back issue. Long sold out in print, but you can get that digital version at the link in the show notes. So that's Mike W. Barsh. Thanks for letting me talk about him.
Well, now we are going to go on to the last and best story of the issue. It is The Great Campus Kidnap, starring Robin. 10 pages, written by Jack C. Harris, penciled by Kurt Schaffenberger, inked by Vince Coletta, and it was later reprinted in Robin, the Bronze Age Omnibus hardcover from 2020. Robin in The Great Campus Kidnap. Our Jack C. Harris written story starts off like a Bob Razakis story, with an action set piece and the star remembering back to how they got here. The story then picks up in the registration office of Hudson U, where Dick Grayson is talking to Bernie Johnson and kind of rubbing it in his face that Dick doesn't have to worry about tuition. Bernie gives Dick the information to report to Kenmore Hall. That must be in the Sears location of campus. But on his way there, he sees Jennifer Ann and tries to strike up a conversation with her, but he strikes out. But only because before he can use that Grayson charm on her, she's kidnapped. Dick quickly changes to Robin, but loses the van due to a smokescreen. He does, however, find out that multiple vans have been used, and he surmises that all of the kidnappees have been transferred into one van and then taken to one location. While telling this information to Chief McDonald, he finds out that Dick Grayson is missing as well. In order to stop the police from looking for him, Robin slash Dick calls Kenmore Hall and finds out that no one was scheduled to report there today. Holy fair play! That means Bernie had something to do with the kidnapping. A few panels later, and Robin is tackling and roping up Bernie outside of the post office, who lets him know that, yep, he did it for the money, and the thugs who kidnapped the kids are holding them in the new sports arena. This is where we catch up to the beginning of the story, with Robin straddling himself between two buildings to get into the only room big enough in a sports arena to hold four kids. He acids his way past the bars, and when the space ghost themed thugs, I love a theme, come into the room, Robin makes short acrobatic work of them. The next night, Dick and Jennifer Ann are talking and kissing and figure out that Bernie was at the post office to mail out ransom notes to their parents. One quick call to Bruce later brings our story to a close. What did you think, Dave?
I like this one a lot. It made sense. Yes, he had that goofy, we had one room, but Robin's using his brain, his investigative skills. I like Kurt Schaffenberger, mainly from the Superman books, but no notes on this one. I love this one.
How about you, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, there's still plenty of panels where Robin looks young, as we've talked about many times. Another set of random friends from Jack C. Harris getting away from the supporting characters that Bob used. The girls look cute. I attribute that to Vince Coletta. A Chekhov kid who needs money, but overall, really a fun story.
Yeah, I like, and I know we don't rate what the story of the issue is, but this is the story of the issue for me. Yeah. I liked it a lot. It's Robin. He's getting action. He's figuring stuff out. Schaffenberger, sometimes I think Robin looks like a college student. Sometimes he does look a little bit young. We talk about that all the time. If I do say so myself, I think the synopsis did beat by beat. So if there's anything specific you want to get into.
If you look at the art on page one in the inset of the circle with Robin, he's sweating because he's climbing up those walls. I thought that was pretty good art. I think it's funny how he ignores the guy saying, hey, Grayson, and goes after the girl. And that's why he doesn't get kidnapped. This good old buddy horn dog Dick going on after the girl is what saves him. Good cycle action on page 4 and 5. You can hear the music and the montage scene at the bottom of page 5. I don't know. I guess that's supposed to be detective work, right?
It feels very Filmation in the way the montage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good catch.
I like how he drives his motorcycle up the steps of the post office to catch Bernie.
But I do like that because I talked about like Holy Fair Play. When I read that, I knew, okay, it was at least you know Bernie has something to do with it. And I think that is good. Like, I think
absolutely. That's totally a clue. It does funny that the easiest way to get to this room is to climb up through those two buildings and kind of silly. I don't know why he was worried so much because he's easily takes out many thugs at once. The only story weakness is a little artificial that he has to rescue them and get them out of the room. He can mop up the floor with these guys, no problem.
I will counter that by saying he could fight them, but those guys have guns. So one of the kids could have been collateral damage.
That's,
so it makes sense to get them out of the way
first. Okay. That's, all right. I'll buy that.
Really good. And I like when he is getting into that room and the kids are like, look, it's Robin. We're rescued.
And he's like, shh.
Don't tell Lois about the cars and the bark in the jelly parking lot. And we even have a new post Lori Elton love interest. We don't ever see her again.
I don't know. I do think it's funny in the last panel how Alfred's upset and just as Bruce is picking up the phone. Was that the next day? Did the mail get there overnight? Yeah. How did Alfred get that mail already?
My guess is that we will be talking about that.
Oh, okay. I won't say anything else.
I think we will be talking about that when we go to Gabriel's Horn.
Dave, you have anything else you want to say about this story?
No, I think we hit all the notes.
This is a good, fun story. Now it's time to go dancing, take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, that hip-hop and hangout for the Teen Titans in the 1970s and even into 1980. We'll talk about the most 70s moment from any of the stories. So let's talk about what you guys got, the Batman story. Any Gabriel's Horn moments for you guys?
I have one small one. I mean, this whole issue, I don't have a lot of good ones.
Dave, do you have anything?
Not from the first one, no.
Yeah, the only thing I had, it's a skyjacking, which was kind of a 70s thing. Mm-hmm. Of course, all the equipment of the airport. There's an ashtray on page 5, I noted. There's an intercom on Bruce's desks. Was that yours?
That was mine. Yep.
And then I don't remember this one. Page 16, there's a TV antenna. Oh yeah, Batman uses a TV antenna to jump from one place to another. So that's kind of a 70s thing. So yeah, nothing great. What was yours?
Now, in that first story, so this is not a, in fact, it's absolutely not a 70s reference, but if you look at page 16 in that first story, and I want you to look at page 16 in that first story, the very last panel, you'll see over Commissioner Gordon's shoulder is the William Shakespeare bust from the Batman 66 TV show.
That's awesome. But that's in Gordon's house. That should be way better.
Well, the prop department saw it there. They needed set dressings.
That's really cool. I didn't notice that. That's awesome. How about in Tales of Gotham City? Do you guys have any Gabriel Horn moment? I have only one.
I was hoping they would say how much a subway token cost, but they didn't.
If you look at the trash can on the first page, you see a metal gas can is what it looks like. They don't do that anymore for good reason. It'll blow up.
Oh, yeah. Good. That is fantastic.
I did not notice that. Mine was pretty weak. I just had the guy sitting on the steps with the paper bag. Forget his libation. And then Batgirl, what'd you guys have there?
I didn't have anything.
Nothing we haven't seen before. Paper file cabinets, of course. Gang wars in general were kind of thematic. And Switchblade the guy has. Again, all kind of 70s things, but not...
I would guess maybe the jackets. I don't know the gang members really. I mean, you have colors, but you don't really have like jackets that, I guess.
There's one big one in the Elongated Man story. Dave?
Is that the collar?
No.
I think I know what part. The tape recorder?
No, that's not what I had. That's a good one. This car is supposed to solve the energy crisis, which
you
know, is ironic that here we are in 1979. This story would have been like more appropriate in 1973, but yeah.
Earlier, you were talking about Batman Filmation, but your Batman Filmation was the first one. So in the New Adventures of Batman, wasn't there one with, didn't they feed garbage into that machine and it turned it into fabric?
Well, if it turned into fabric, yeah, but they stole gas in that one. They actually held it in a building. It was Catwoman and I can't remember who she teamed up with.
And then there are a few in the Robin story. Dave, what do you have?
Well, besides the windowless van we've already mentioned. The jacket.
Yep.
Dick's jacket for sure.
Yeah. Is it a jacket or is it a shirt? I don't know what it is, but man, that's really 70s.
Yeah.
We'll definitely have a picture of that one. How about you, Sean? Do you have any others?
On page 2, when he calls Jennifer Anna Fox.
Yeah. That's a good one.
And then, of course, this is probably the biggest one. On page 10, when they're talking about mailing ransom letters through the post office.
I have the same thing. The switchboard operator on the top of page 7, you see her. Dick calls the university and gets a switchboard operator. And then, of course, there's a telephone booth at the on the last page.
Yeah,
that's all I had.
Yeah.
Yeah, our Gabriel's horns have dwindled.
Yeah.
Well, part of it is there's lots that the first time we saw ashtrays, we made a big deal of it, right? Now we see them and it's not quite as big deal. So, yeah, but they're definitely not as prevalent as they used to be. But, you know, of course, now we've finished out the 70s.
That sums it up for this issue. We want to thank our special guest, J. David Weider, for stopping by the reunion this month. David, do you want to tell our listeners where they can find you and your podcast?
Yep, you'll find me and Bill Beer at thebatpod.com. And of course, on the usual suspects, I almost said iTunes because now I feel old. Apple Music.
That's my Gabriel's Horn reference.
Yep, there you go. You're welcome. And Spotify, etc. And it's me and Bill just doing back issues of Batman titles.
Great podcast. Enjoy it a lot.
All right. Now we're going to play a podcast promo. And when we return, we will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Grab your bat microphone. It's time to start the show.
Welcome to the Bat Pod, a Batman comic book discussion podcast.
What are you doing? That's my line.
I'm starting the show. I was waiting on you. We're starting the show.
I'm the one that says that. You're my new co-host, where we talk about back issues of Batman. Could be in Detective Comics, World Finest.
Could we do some Shadow of the Bat and maybe some Nightwing, maybe some Batgirl?
Absolutely.
Can we also define where my co-hosting parameters start and end? I can't start the show, but I can definitely co-host it.
Well, maybe we'll let you start the show.
Okay, at least I get to pick one of the books we're covering on each episode, and you can pick the other?
Absolutely.
Can I close out the show? Can I bring friends? Will there be snacks?
What is your favorite bat snack?
Cucumber sandwiches.
Join Bill Beer and J. David Weider every 2 weeks on the Bat Pod. You can find us on your favorite podcast app.
Grab your headphones, listen up. You know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
Welcome back. Now we will read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 487, Sergius, Roy Raymond, and the Odd Man, with our special guest, Martin Gray. First up, our bat cousin and podcasting all-star, Chris Franklin, says, "Fun discussion, gents. Always a pleasure to hear Martin on the network. I always forget that this cover goes with this issue, as apparently I lost the cover very early after buying this off the stands. Hey, I was 4. As for all the fonts, I have to agree. I know several designers who subscribe to font assault to get people's attention, but I think it just becomes a jumble no one can or will read. I think you guys were heading in that direction, but Ma Mabel Maherder, the H is silent, does seem to be a riff on Ma Parker, Shelley Winter's character from the 60s Batman TV series, which was in turn inspired by the real-life criminal Ma Barker. So odd that Denny, who never seemed to care much for the 60s TV show, and was the primary writer associated with swerving the Batman books away from its influence, was apparently inspired by it during this era. Thank you for the wonderful segment on Don Newton. His first Batman solo tale was one of my earliest comics, The Backup in Batman number 305, and I followed him nearly every month thereafter. His Batman is seminal to me, and when his death was announced in Dick Giordano's Meanwhile column, I was heartbroken. No less than Batman master Dick Sprang praised Newton's work for his amazing physicality. Despite the more realistic approach, I think some of Sprang's talent for unique faces was also part of Newton's charm as well, as you pointed out in this issue. I remember being utterly confused by the Roy Raymond tale as a kid. Why was Hulk Girl in this? Kind of charming now, but still odd. But not as odd as we'll get later. That image of Robin's elongated leg is still etched in my brain. It was years before I realized it was his cape. At the time, when my mom read this to me, again, I couldn't read yet, and I questioned it, she surmised that it was his tights, as she pointed out to me that Robin, Burt Ward, wore tights on the TV series.
Okay, I gotta stop you there. How does he remember his mom reading him this story at 4 years old? Chris, that's your superpower. That's incredible. I know you were born with a comic book coming out of boom. Sorry, I just found that amazing.
Maybe Chris has an eidetic memory.
Maybe he does.
The Odd Man. I think most people often forget that this story ever saw print, figuring he was a full-blown victim of the DC implosion. Ditko was definitely staying in his lane, with Odd Man seeming to be a combination of The Question, The Creeper, and maybe a sprinkle of Shade the Changing Man thrown in. At least he kept Mr. A out of it. Dick Giordano is the John Romita of DC Comics, the master of drawing beautiful women, with Bob Oxner and Nick Carty right behind him. Babs looks beautiful here, and I like the callback to her early costume transformations from cape to skirt, although she seems to have lost her bat scallops in a few panels. My local comic shop always seemed to have some issues of New Adventures of Superboy in their dollar bins, and I've been filling my collection here and there. As a kid, I really enjoyed the series, despite preferring the movie continuity with no Superboy. Oh, and those dinosaur toys were model kits. Also, Sean's rivet gun may have been a victim of legislation and self-censorship by the toy industry in the late 70s after a toddler choked to death on a Battlestar Galactica missile. This is the reason the advertised mail-in rocket-firing Boba Fett figure came with the rocket welded in place. Small projectiles were out for toy manufacturers.
This is where you say, dumb kid?
No, this. I am glad that I self-corrected myself in the same sentence. I turned myself around, and I'm glad I did.
Next up, we have Bat Cousin and future guest, Brian Schufo. I knew nothing of Don Newton's history and was shocked to hear that he died so suddenly at an age younger than most of the people who are listening to this podcast. Riveton. I loved my Riveton set. The little rubber rivets would be stretched by the rivet gun, placed into the holes of the two pieces to join, and then unstretched to hold everything in place. It was brilliant. If memory serves, the rivets were rather bitter. The commercial tagline went something like, Riveton, Riveton, on and on and on.
Rivetron, Rivetron, on and on and on.
I tried to find a video on the TV, but you didn't need that because Sean just sang it. I did find a UK version, which honestly sounds much cooler. And then, listeners, Brian did post a link to YouTube. You should check it out. Back to Brian, who has a message for our bat nephew. Thank you, Isamu, for finding and summarizing the missing issue of the Superman stripping issue. Your efforts every episode are so much appreciated.
Amen, brother.
Amen.
Now we hear from New Florida resident, noted film historian, and podcasting all-star Rob Kelly, who says, hey guys, really excited to hear the official announcement of your new show, The Podman, coming soon. That'll be a quick one-episode series. Like so many of my fellow nerds, I remember those DC Explosion house ads and wondering who that weird dude in the back was. I wasn't buying Detective at the time, so I didn't know that The Odd Man ever made an appearance in an actual comic. Sorry to say, going by what you posted, I wish I hadn't. I love his look and the concept, but dear God, do I hate Ditko's art during those years. He deserves all the praise he gets from his innovative work at Marvel and later DC and Charlton. But to my eyes, by this point, his stuff is just unreadable. Awkward, cartoonish in all the wrong ways, and completely dull layouts. The Odd Man deserved better. Coloring aside, the cover by JLGL should have been a poster, or at the very least used for the DC style guide. Completely iconic shot of the Batman family, to which Chris Franklin came back to add, funny you should mention that, Rob. It jogged my memory that the cover image was issued as a poster. And then Chris posted an eBay link and a photo of the poster, and it looks way better with the pink sky contrasting the building. Back to Rob, who closes with two thoughts. Martin, if you love Plastic Man, keep an ear out for a future episode of the Power Records podcast coming soon. Yay, this is Sean. I'm happy because I love listening to that. Back to Rob. I'm sure Mom Murder dined out on Batman saying she was as dangerous as the Joker for years. In Gotham City, that's the kind of pull quote money can't buy. I can picture her at Arkham Con 79 with a banner behind her that says it. That way, she can justify charging $50 for an autograph.
Next up, past guest and our Bat Cousin, Captain Entropy, wanted to make a few points. Bat Cousins, I'm sorry I've been missing from the comments pages lately, but I have been enjoying the episodes. This one was great too, especially with Martin as the guest. Some quick trivia. First, there is still a U.S. military base at Stuttgart, and it's considered a primo assignment. I have some friends who headed out there a couple years ago. They do want to return to Florida, though. Something about winter and the devaluing of the dollar. Martin, I caught your point about every soldier in the story being portrayed as a crook. We have had occasionally problems with government property leaving out the back door, so I can't fault the plot, but I do prefer when they show that most in the service are good guys and gals. Regardless, this is better than how DC portrayed us in the 90s. Also, that truck looks small for moving tanks around. Speaking of tanks, I've never heard of a sideways tank, but I may suggest it. They can file it with my other suggestions, like a helicarrier and midair reloading and munitions that burrow like Cave Carson and war wheels. Nobody takes me serious for some reason. Also, TK-170s are probably in the DoD inventory, but they're toner cartridges. Finally, Sean, I think the word you're looking for regarding Ditko's creation of the Odd Man is audacity. As in, that Stevie wasn't half audacious. I appreciate the education always, but especially the schooling this time on the great Don Newton. I loved his work for the past 45 years. And that mystery from the house ad, The Odd Man. Unspoken comment from a previous episode. Kurt Schaffenberger was indeed a hero. Ones of tens of thousands over the years who have proven what a boon immigrants are to our national security, among many other aspects of American life. Thanks for that bit of learning, too. You're welcome, Captain. Thank you. Then we heard from our Bat Cousin Lizanne Oswalt. Impressive podcast, most impressive. That is a pretty cool cover. Though from the angle Bruce is coming in, well, normally a man buys me dinner first. Ma Murder is an old lady who likes her suits. Good for her. It's a bit tacky, but still. Roy Raymond, I mostly knew him from Who's Who. Drawn by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez in Who's Who, which I had forgotten. The story is fine for a 70s story. Ah, the Odd Man, pure Ditko. They need to bring the Odd Man back for a Vertigo-type line. Well, Lizanne, I did search it out after Martin, and there is a backup story. It doesn't really star the Odd Man. It stars his daughter, and there's a couple shots of him in the Odd Man's suit in that Vertigo-type book. Anyway, cool podcast. Can't wait for the next one. Thanks, Lizanne.
Next up, Bucky749 stopped by to talk about taco bars, but he did mention that he enjoyed the show. Thanks, Buck. And then a short comment from our bat nephew, Isamu, who couldn't resist. Sounds like the Odd Man was the odd man out in this one, or perhaps the odd man in. We hear from our Bat DJ and future guest, Matthew Davis. Hello, Bat Cousins. Hope everyone else is having as much fun as Sean, Paul, and Martin had discussing this issue. Such an unassuming issue of the series with a few ups and downs behind that simple but fantastic cover by JLGLPBHN. Batman. His song selection is Paperback Writer by the Beatles, and I know that one. Hey, Ma. If your last name is literally murder, but with an H stuck in a weird place, and you're accused of murder, don't blame the media for the nickname. And murder has to be pronounced the way Alan Cummings says it in The Traitors. No ifs, ands, or buts. So I do know all of the song references, but I haven't watched The Traitors. I don't know that I'm going to. There's so many stuff, so many things on streaming that, by the way, the new season of Girls 5 Ever dropped, and it's fantastic, so let's watch that. Okay, back to Matthew. Roy Raymond, TV Detective. The theme from Close Encounters of the Third Kind by John Williams. Sean's synopsis was more exciting than this story. So, Bat Cousins, I'm going to let you in on a secret. The better and more well-written the story is, the less I feel the need to make fun and stuff. But if I don't like a story at all, I feel I need to punch it up with a good synopsis. So that's so in a way, I hope they're bad stories because they're more easy to make fun of. The Robin story, 99 Luftballons by Nina, the German language version. So Robin stocked up at Spencer's for a foot sticking out of a car truck prank and got the Ralph Dibny licensed version. Unless those soldiers were living and shopping off base, I don't know about that devaluation excuse. My parents and I lived on base in West Germany in the early 1970s. I was just a kid and didn't pay too much attention to the price of groceries then, but I do remember the markup at the PX post exchange which is the Walmart for soldiers and dependents, for those who don't know, was not as much as at civilian stores. This is the part where Matthew floored me. Even comic books were a little below cover price.
Nice.
In the late 70s, after moving back to the US, my mother and I would make a trip every month or so to one of the military bases near Atlanta to stock up at the PX because the prices were cheaper, there was no sales tax, and she also used coupons to maximize the savings. My mother was a master at penny pinching. For your information, oh, here we go. Krabbenlock Krasnern was an actual U.S. Army base outside of Stuttgart. I'm guessing that writer Jack C. Harris was stationed there or nearby when he served. The next story, The Odd Man. Walk Like an Egyptian by the Bengals and King Tut by Steve Martin. The first one hit my ears while reading, but the second one while listening to the episode. This story falls into the it's so bad it's good camp. Is it no surprise that a character called the Odd Man is created by Steve Ditko and the character's secret identity is Clay Stoner? Yeah, tell me Ditko wasn't on something. And yet, what is this guy's origin story? Was he a test subject for secret CIA LSD experiments? Oddly, no pun intended, enough, I was a fan of Ditko's Starman series in Adventure Comics. So this is Sean speaking. Yeah, I have all of those Starman from Adventure because I bought it for Plastic Man. And I even have the DC Comics appearance with Starman. So coming up closer to the middle of the year, where I work, our fiscal year ends in June. So all of my vacation time has to be taken. So probably in May or June, I'll take a staycation. And during that time, I plan to read that Starman run. Back to Matthew. And if James Gunn isn't aware of this character, well, he really needs to be. The Batgirl story. Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow by Fleetwood Mac. Perennially popular at campaign rallies. It's always good to see Dick Giordano's artwork, but odd to see someone else inking his pencils. A couple of 70s moments you may have missed. The soldiers were wearing solid colored fatigues as opposed to the typical camo ones today. That is a fantastic
That's spot. A good one. I would have never got that.
And I'm surprised none of you mentioned the board member in the Robin story with a Princess Leia hairdo.
And finally, two-time past guest, Brett Cousin Brett Young, closes out our comments. Hey, Bat Cousin, sorry I'm late. I was at the movies when some weird fight broke out with a lot of snappy quips. Anyway, I brought some old lady's box of popcorns for everybody to share. I love the cover by JLGL. I don't mind the muddy sky because it mutes the whole background and lets the heroes stand out better. I don't even mind that it's in the box. This would make a cool poster. Don Newton kills it again with his art on the Batman story. His thugs always make me think of the assassins Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd from Diamonds Are Forever. Just distinctive weirdos looking to kill. I'm very disappointed that the League of Assassins moved out of the parking garage, however. Seems like a solid tax shelter and a lot cheaper rent than the Lower East Side's water-sealed apartments. Of course, who needs to pay for air conditioning when you could just fill up the living room for a cool dip? Laugh all you want, but if you live in the city where the Joker is blowing poisonous gas out of a blimp every other week, it's worth a little extra to get the airtight condo. Check Zillow for details. If the League wanted a low profile, why'd they hang out as teenagers when Batman's there? First Sensei gets busted for his vanity plates. Now his goons are busted for outdated footwear. I better not sport my Chuck Taylors around Batman or I might get punched in the face. Speaking of footwear, Sensei, if you're going to lounge on your sectional with your hookah pipe, take your shoes off like a gentleman. Congratulations, Sean. Reading Roy Raymond and the Odd Man made me long for a Batmite story instead. Oh, yes, a zing. Once again, listings for Gotham real estate would have been way better than these clowns. Finally, Batgirl got a great artist. Unfortunately, she lost my vote. Fear-mongering while ignoring the budgetary needs for jobs and housing and education. You're better than this, Babs. Well, I gotta go. Great Aunt Penelope is trying to proofread this post backwards and looks like she's about to have a stroke.
Now we're going to turn to our social media channels. I'm just going to combine everything into one mega read. So on Facebook and Twitter, we got likes, shares, retweets, all of those kind of things from Chris Franklin, Tom Pincinault, Max Romero, Bill Bear, Mike Thomas, Terry O'Malley, A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, Jack Dower, Codex Omniversa, Farnick Tomes, Tim Price, Doug Game Master, Alistair James Dunbar, Scott Rowland, Harold Wallen, Don Lindberg, Matthew Davis, Jay Wiseman, Michael Atchison, Paul Wildenberger, Jay Campbell, Jim Owsley, Rob Kelly, Shag Matthews, Chris at BTO and Batbooks, Paul Pont, Lizanne Oswald, Brian Schufo, Isamu, Matt J, Dr. Pop Culture, CJ Hart Comics, Cindy Womack, Yomar Jimenez, Nafarada, Mike D. White, Rue Frank, Cutting Edge Comics, Steve Whitbread, Rodney Trainum, Dr. Gordon B. Schmidt, Kailash Walla Muckney. If I've pronounced that incorrectly, please let me know and I will correct that. Mike Deans, Martin Gray, Keith G. Baker, Irredeemable Shag, and Firestorm Fan. But before we turn away from social media, I want to point out on our Twitter feed, which is BatFam Reunion, Martin Manza mentioned that he had a collage from the world's greatest superheroes comic strip, and he posted that collage, and it looks fantastic. So I urge everyone to go and look at that. It looks fantastic. It's so well done. The other comment I want to talk about, Brian Schufo posted that DC Explosion ad that most people are familiar with, the heroes standing and they're all going towards the center. So you have Hawkman, Enemy Ace, Big Barda, The Ray, The Odd Man, OMAC. You have an Amazon, Martian Manhunter, The Atom, but most importantly, Deadman. And he said, when this ad was first published, I knew who The Atom and Hawkman were. Years later, I figured out Barda, The Ray, OMAC, Martian Manhunter, and Deadman. This week, Odd Man. To close out the 50-year mystery, who are the pilot and the woman with the sword? And Rodney Trainum said, Enemy Ace was slated to be in Men of War, and there was to be an Amazon's feature in Wonder Woman. And then he said, check out tomorrow's comic book implosion, if you're interested. A new expanded edition is coming out soon. It's a great resource of information about those backup features that were published or intended to be published and more. And I second that. That book is fantastic. Comic book implosion. I haven't read everything from Tomorrow's, but it's right up there. It is fantastic. I don't get paid to do that. I paid for my copy.
All right. So before we sign off, though, as most of you know, running the Fire and Water Network has gotten more costly over the years. So if you're enjoying what you hear on the show or any of the other shows, please consider becoming a patron. At certain levels, you get a call out on the show of your choice. And our special thanks go out to our Bat cousin and future guest, Brian Schufo, who has asked to be named on the Batman Family Reunion. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Remember, we're not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount you can give helps defray the cost. And we promise none of the money will go towards developing a collapsing car. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FWpodcasts. And thanks.
That will do it for the feedback section and for episode 488. We want to thank our special guest, David Werder. If you don't listen to the Batpod, well, you should. Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us next month as we get our final Robin Batgirl team up, two Batman tales, and the Atom?